Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Insight is Capital. There's a new kind of financial media emerging, not the breathless ticker chasing of cable TV, not the sanitized press releases of the fund industry, but something more useful, something far more useful, independent analysts who actually read the prospectus, run the numbers, and tell you what they actually think. Tony Dong, founder and owner of ETF portfolio Blueprint.com, has built exactly that. He has quietly become one of the most followed independent ETF destinations on the internet. And if you spend any time in ETF communities online, you've almost certainly come across his work, whether you knew it or not. There's a reason it spreads the way it does. He writes with a clarity and intellectual honesty that's genuinely rare in this space. He also happens to be the lead ETF analyst at ETF Central, a partnership between Track Insight and the New York Stock Exchange, with bylines at U.S. News and World Report, Money Sense, Kiplinger, The Motley Fool, and Business Insider, among others. He holds a master's in risk management from Columbia University and the CETF designation. He quit his day job in 2022, went all in on writing about ETFs, and never looked back. What makes him different isn't the volume of his output, though it is prodigious. It's the willingness to change his mind publicly, to call out overvalued thematic trades, and to build model portfolios designed to actually survive the world we're living in right now. Hybrid warfare, tail risk, geopolitical regime change. Not the world we had the last 40 years. He's here to talk today about defense tech ETFs, tail risk, and what it means to build a portfolio for a world that feels a lot less predictable than it used to.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Tony, welcome. It is terrific to have you back on the show.
It's always good to be here.
Yeah, thanks again for joining us. Q1 was something, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's a saying that there are years where nothing happens and there are weeks where years happen. And keep in mind, we're only in the second year of this presidency. And coincidentally, last year around April, we had tariffs, right? And now this year is war. So for the next two, I think it's important to keep an open mind and not fall under the guise that, oh, nothing ever happens, right? Because things are happening right now.
Yeah. Hey, and Q2, which we've just started, we're here in April, today's April 20th. We're already off to a pretty climactic start. New all-time highs on the Friday close. If anyone had told you this was going to be the outcome at the beginning of March or at the end of February, whatever, you know, however you want to time it, would you have imagined that we'd have this kind of melt up?
No, honestly not. Evaluations at the start of the year were already stretched. You look at Shiller CAPE, which is a cyclically adjusted PE ratio, already hovering around dot-com highs above 40, right? So you're entering there with that at that level, the Buffett indicator above 200%, which is market cap relative to gross domestic product. And you had significant weakness in the Magnificent Seven. But I think what helped was there is a surprising amount of breadth in the S&P 500 in that it's not just being held up by a select group of megatechs anymore. We're heading into an earnings season where a lot of analysts have revised their forecasts to be, you know, more bullish. And I understand there's a bit of recency bias at play there, but that does affect sentiment on the street. And I think that the hidden part people are underestimating is that these second order effects from the conflict are going to take a while to bleed in. We just had the inflation print come back for Canada.
Yeah.
This month's print was 2.4%, still a little hot, and you just had the Bank of Canada hold. So it really sets us up for an interesting dynamic where one can acknowledge simultaneously that the economy maybe isn't doing that well, but the markets are doing fantastic. And I think that plays into the dynamic today where there are asset owners and there are non-asset owners. And depending on where you are, you're going to be experiencing a very different outcome. And that's the K-shaped economy everybody's been mentioning.
It's been nothing short of interesting in terms of you know, things to talk about and ways to you know, understand what's going on in the economy at large. But I think when you take the two, you know, the two ends of the K, the top end of the K and the bottom end of the K, and you combine them, that's really the part that's been kind of deceiving about the economy, is that on one end you have great prosperity, endless, you know, asset prices rising, or sort of has felt for quite some time. And then on the other side, you know, on the lower end of the K, you've got, you know, borrowers and non-savers sort of, you know, at the mercy of inflation, interest rates, AI, you know, and that. So again, like, everything seems to be, you know, divergent. And AI has sort of, you know, enhanced it, right? It has increased the risks at the lower end of the cave. And, you know, the vulnerability, the fragility of it. But so interesting, you know, interesting take, Tony. So I wanted to specifically get into a couple of areas, which I've sort of prefaced in my opening remarks, which was, for starters, defense tech. But let's talk about defense and defense tech as a key theme. You've covered that over the last year or so. When you look under the hood of defense ETFs, what separates the ones worth owning from the ones that just dress up as defense? And what should, if there is a specific view on what Canadian investors should be specifically watching for, or investors in general, what do you think they should be watching for when looking at these thematic plays on defense?
Yeah, so I'm of the opinion that most defense ETFs are just industrial sector ETFs with a trumped up expense ratio and a different title, right? If you look what's in the portfolio, it's largely commercial aerospace dominated, sometimes even logistics, and they're very far down the service chain. Ideally, and this is just my personal opinion, if you wanted exposure to defense tech, you should be looking at the prime contractors. We are talking the ones first in line with the DoD with billions and backlogs. And when there's a saying out there that, you know, when people buy airlines, they're not actually buying airlines, like, they're buying a derivative to the price of oil. When you buy defense stocks, that is a derivative on government defense budgets. They're not just exposed to it, they are dependent on it. So if you want, like, pure play defense exposure, you want names where 60 to 90% of revenue comes from defense contracts. And again, in that waterfall of how contractors have primacy, you want to be in the prime contractors there. True defense contractors like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Dynamics, they run on multi-year procurement cycles. You know, it's a folly to focus on quarterly earnings for these companies, because what you're buying is both the duration of the backlog and also your assessment of how probable it is that they fulfill it on time and are able to recognize that revenue, right? But, you know, moving beyond the prime contractors, there are also bottlenecks of ancillary or secondary contractors that matter. Think about the companies that supply the primes with propulsion systems, guidance systems. So things like Honeywell with their aerospace division, which, by the way, is going to be spun off on its own soon. And L3Harris with their guidance systems and what's it called? ISR, so integrated surveillance and reconnaissance. This is where the pricing power is, especially for companies like TransDigm, who are able to use a roll-up tuck-in acquisition to consolidate a very fragmented industry while nobody notices. You know, everybody's focused on Google for anti-competition. Some of these defense contractors are just as bad, but they escape scrutiny because it's not a headline-making thing. To bring it back to ETFs, for Canadian investors, there's not a lot of options. You have two. You have one from iShares, which is XAD, which is pretty much a ETF of ETFs of their U.S. domicile defense ETF, ITA. That is a suboptimal benchmark because the Dow Jones index it uses is market cap weighted with little in the way of restrictions. So you have like two or three companies like General Electric making up 15 to 30% of the portfolio altogether is very top heavy. Your only other option in Canada at this moment, and there may be more filed, I'm not sure, is from Global X, SHLD, which I like because it strips out the aerospace dependency. It's much more defense focused, and it's not U.S. based only. You capture Korea's defense segment, which there's a lot of technology in there, and you capture Europe's segment, which later I'm going to talk about the whole rearmament cycle and all the billions of dollars in commitments and future equity they have earmarked.
That's a great overview. I think it's one of those areas that you know, until the Trump administration came in, you know, into power last year, was typically it was getting a lot of watch, but it wasn't getting that kind of the kind of watch it's getting today since the One Big Beautiful Bill and the demand against NATO to raise their defense spending, right? And
yeah.
So there's a lot of questions there, you know, about you know, can Europe increase their budgets, you know, to 5% of GDP for defense? There's some debate about that, but either way, the budgets are going up. And then, you know, I had an interesting conversation with Jeremy Schwartz.
From Wisdom Tree?
From Wisdom Tree. Schwartz and Jeff Winiger were on our other podcast. And Jeremy made a point of talking about the idea that we are at the beginning of a defense tech supercycle. But he made an interesting link between not just pure defense, but the fact that, you know, at the heart of technology is the government. And, you know, that the government was responsible, you know, because the government wanted the internet for its own use in the first place. You know, the original internet, DARPANET, was created, and that spawned, you know, what we now know as the internet. And that, so at the core of all technology is this government innovation project. And so his outlook for defense tech was that we are at the beginning of a defense tech supercycle. And in that case, it goes to your point. I mean, it not only encompasses the primary defense contractors like Raytheon, Lockheed, Boeing, but it also trickles down into the suppliers of those companies of ancillary technologies. But it also, furthermore, it also adds to the technology development innovation base of the entire economy, because all that defense spending or defense tech related spending does trickle into the tech sector as well, whether it's directly or indirectly. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the supercycle question. Are we at the beginning of a defense tech supercycle? And if so, I think the second question is, to what extent has the market priced ahead in terms of valuation? Because it's one thing to have the idea, I want to invest in this sector, but the price you pay is what determines the returns that you get over the long term. So if you come in at a high point, not everybody might agree with this, but if you come in at a high price, you might be waiting a little bit longer to capture the long-term returns of that sector.
So I think Schwartz is right. He's partially right. When that's just my opinion. Like I love Jeremy, what he does. They just launched a defense ETF too. I think WDEF or something from WisdomTree.
Right.
But we're not at the start of a defense supercycle. We're flat out in the middle of one. This started after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I'm not talking about the Donbass conflict going back to 2014. I'm talking about that moment. You had that convoy cross the border from Belarus going towards Kyiv. That was the moment it started. And as for, you know, valuations, like, people want a clean answer here. There isn't. You're dealing with two opposing forces. Excess valuation means mean reversion, but regime change is rare and violent when it happens. We know wars exist, but what's different is a number of different factors. So NATO budgets moving towards 2% plus of GDP as a floor, not as a ceiling. Europe is reindustrializing its defense capacity. You know, member countries of NATO targeting 5%, right? 3.5%
right.
To core military expenditures, 1.5% to critical infrastructure and civil defense. Those are the ones where I think it's appropriate to run a deficit because they're nation building activities. They create meaningful jobs and they have a GDP impact far beyond the immediate deficit. It's a very big break from the 2014 framework. You look at Rearm Europe 2, where it's over 800 billion in euros for defense-related spending. And of that, 150 billion is a loan facility under so-called Security Action for Europe, or SAFE, which is meant to improve procurement. Right. NATO and the EU in general is aware that the US is more isolationist and more interventionist, albeit not in their interests as is before. This is not the Kuwait Desert Shield, Desert Storm days where the last time we saw that Thunder Run coalition, it's not that anymore. It's a multipolar world with a waning superpower, and I am of the opinion that the U.S. is on a decline right now. And you can tell because the last thing to go in any superpower before the decline with the English, the Dutch, the Chinese in many cycles before are the loss of reserve currency status and a military defeat. And not tactically, but strategically, as in, like, you committed a large amount of troops and resources and you were not able to meet the goals you set out at the beginning, or those goals were not undefined. And in the process of doing so, you created significant damage to the global economy. That's what's going on right now in the Strait of Hormuz. So I am looking at the US dollar right now as a gauge of this. But to bring it back to defense, we know markets front-run narratives. But when you're buying defense, you're buying consensus belief about future conflicts, and hoping that you've discounted backlogs for these contractors appropriately to the present. People get defense investing go wrong when they chase defense after a headline comes out, when they build exposure only when it feels necessary, and they're not willing to look wrong for stretches of time. This makes you exit liquidity.
Right.
I think that of all the ways to invest thematically, and there's a lot of bad ones here that just chase hype, I think that the soundest long-term allocations that you should just stick to, energy and defense. It's been time immemorial. People in the old days used to fight for firewood, used to fight for coal. Back to the Bronze Age, we had a vibrant arms industry. Nothing has changed, but the scale and the capacity and the capital flowing into it.
In the course of the year, Tony, you publicly changed your view on defense ETFs at least once based on valuations. But geopolitical events keep creating new entry points. How do you think about the tension between valuation discipline and the very real possibility that defense spending is entering a structurally higher regime?
Defense, there's an interesting International Monetary Fund / World Economic Forum series of charts that just came out that show that defense spending is primarily funded by budget deficits, if not outright cuts to social services. And the social implications of that aside, it's horrible. But, you know, when you are long defense, you're intrinsically long the ability of the government to persist with a substantial deficit and remain credit worthy, right? It is a very lopsided trade where you are hoping that whoever's in charge, whoever's the incumbent, can still go ahead. As soon as America loses a war and the reserve currency status goes, this is going to end. This is going to collapse. The market isn't going to crash, but these premiums where investors are willing to pay 40, 50 times for defense names based on forward earnings is going to be gone, right? Which is why this conflict is so important to watch if you're a defense investor. But tempering this are a number of other factors. These include munitions depletion, right? We've had a lot of FAD Patriot missile systems that have been used to rather inefficiently counteract Iranian drones like the Shahed, right? Yeah. If you look at the dollar for dollar cost of each one of them, it's extremely asymmetrical. And more often, when you're on the offensive, you need to commit more forces and resources than your adversary to overwhelm them. And if you can't do that in the first 2 weeks, your logistics chain starts showing stress, your soldiers become fatigued, the public begins to incur war weariness, which makes them less apt to support the political will needed to get this kind of conflict. And what are we on now? Like week 7 of this?
Yeah, I think week 7 or week coming up on week 8.
Yeah. So it's as far as a strategic victory for the US, it's still salvageable for them. But, you know, like it's hard because, like, for someone like Trump, it is hard for him to save face here. And we know that's important for him. Notwithstanding that global trade has been disrupted, that U.S. interests in allied Gulf Arab states have more or less been decimated, that the investability of these Arab states, the same ones that financed U.S. data centers and invested in U.S. techs, has been severely damaged. And global shipping has been re-rated. You can't even get insured to go through the strait anymore. And Iran is collecting fat toll booth style fees from this.
I think the other thing that's kind of interesting, because it's not getting a lot of attention. It's getting some, but not the kind of attention it deserves, is, you know, the choke point in helium, the choke point in sulfur, the choke point in agricultural
potash, urea, agriculture inputs.
I mean, I think those both defense and agricultural inputs and technology inputs are being greatly underestimated. Now, I read some numbers, some statistics yesterday about, you know, the damage at Ras Laffan in Qatar, and it's not nearly as bad as it has been made out to be by some. It's not the full 20% of, you know, which is, it's not 20% of the global production of LNG, helium, et cetera, that's coming out of Ras Laffan that's in jeopardy. It's something more like 3.4 of the world's output, 17% of the 20% was the figure that I sort of came up against. So
yeah, it's really bad for emerging market countries.
That's terrible. I mean, everybody, they're all cutting. They're shutting down. They're shutting down production. They can't get the LNG that they need.
They're incredibly export dependent for their energy, and it's why I'm not buying the emerging market rally this year. Like, first off, that's a lot of like recency bias there. You wrote off emerging markets for the last 15 years. It does well in 2025, and now everybody's piling in. You know, when people say, oh, I'm not buying emerging. No, that's a lie. I see the ETF inflows. I see how much capital is going into this. You know, people are flooding in right now. But you're opting for market cap weighted emerging funds, which means an overweight to China, the main adversary of the U.S. And, you know, that's kind of a reason why the U.S. has so many ex-Chinese emerging market ETFs, because it's more or less an accepted reality that one day it's going to go bad. And, you know, all these Chinese ADRs are going to get delisted or something. You know, there's that risk is there. That's why these funds exist. And secondly, like, these countries are insanely energy import dependent.
Right.
So I would not want to be.
Well, India, especially, you know, India is especially vulnerable.
If there was a trade right now, I would do, it would be long AI and long energy and short India. Shorting India would cancel out all the market risk of your two long legs, and your thesis here would be that, A, they're going to be affected by energy import deficits, and two, the widespread development of agentic AI will undermine their business processing industry, which they basically sped run instead of developing actual industrial capacity, right? You're basically the back center for the developed world there. That's not a bad Paris trade idea, but I don't like shorting, so that's not something I would personally do.
So I think that's a good segue to the next to my next question for you, which is tail risk protection, which you've been writing about, and you specifically touched on two ETFs that you were looking at. One was Chaos, CAOS, and the other one's TAIL, TAIL. Chaos is the ticker for the Alpha Architect Tail Risk ETF, and TAIL is the ticker for the Cambria Investment Management ticker. And, you know, tail risk, you know, I recall conversations from 4 years ago we had on our other podcast. And, you know, that was something that was largely, it was very difficult for a non-institutional investor to partake in. You know, like, you can obviously buy long vol or tail risk protection via options. But it's got bleed, right? So as long as the market is, you know, rising, you're going to continue to experience, you know, bleed as you build that portfolio. But you had an interesting take on Chaos versus tail. And, you know, like, as a tail risk used to feel like something you modeled, but rarely actually lived through or implemented. I think there's been a lot of moments in our investing history, whether it's recent or over the long term, where we would have liked to have some kind of tail risk protection, especially against things like March 2020, for example. Given everything that's already happened this year alone, do you think the tail has moved? And if so, what does that mean for how investors should be positioning, with tail risk in mind, of course?
I want to answer this in two parts. So yeah, the tail has moved, but not in ways that people think. It hasn't moved closer. It's just become fatter and more frequent. You look at the clustering ever since COVID pandemic, war in Europe, energy shock, supply chain fragmentation, now persistent geopolitical escalation. People have already forgot Venezuela, but you know he's eyeing Cuba, right? So the mistake I see a lot of people do is that when they model tail risk, they look at it as a rare, isolated, and mean reverting event. It's not. It's path dependent and compounding. So the mistake I see when people try to insure against this is they look at just standalone insurance you occasionally renew. It's a structural cost of remaining invested. Drag from tail risk is just like taxes. If your portfolio only survives in a smooth bell curve, it's broken, right? And to bring it back to chaos versus tail, I actually like both of them. You're buying, however, a payoff profile, not a product. Tail will pay you well in those sharp, violent discalations. Chaos, actually, on the other hand, tries to survive long enough to be still there in some way or shape when that dislocation happens. A lot of investors, you know, they misunderstand this. They look at a recent crisis and say, oh, the crash is short. I just want the one that melts up the hardest. That's hindsight bias. The real risk is not the crash you see. It's the one that takes longer than your hedge can stay solvent. Negative carry kills more tail risk hedge than bad modeling. So my trade-off here is simple. You accept tail if you want higher convexity but more bleed. You take chaos if you want low bleed but a less explosive payoff. The choice comes down to this. Do you want to die slowly before the event or underperform during the event?
Right.
You can pick your poison, but just know which one you picked.
And what are your thoughts on combining some allocation to both? Seeing as they have two different profiles.
Yeah. Well, just on the basis of reducing manager-specific risk, yeah, probably. You keep something like tail in your non-registered account, and you just use that as a persistent tax loss harvesting opportunity. In a registered account, something like chaos might be more ideal. I personally use chaos. I use it as a cash substitute.
Right.
The guys at Alpha Architect are brilliant.
Wes Gray's phenomenal. So
yeah, they know their stuff. Wes does like a almost like ongoing Q&A on his LinkedIn, and it's worth following because he goes into like all the little tidbits of ETFs that no one talks about, but more people should know. And I've looked at tail before. If I had to choose between long volatility versus tail, I would pick tail. I take a ladder of puts, and Meb Faber, actually, to his credit, offsets that pretty well with the yield from treasuries.
Right.
And it's like before chaos came around, I would probably say tail was the best, tail risk hedge, pun intended. Again, there's no right option. You just pick what payoff you want. There's no free lunch here. You always start by defining the specific risk you're going to hedge against and then working inductively from there to pick the best instruments to carry that out. And for those of you who are saying, well, I don't want to pay the expense ratio. Yeah, holding cash is fine. It's always been fine, especially now where we're in a higher for longer environment.
Right. But you don't get the convexity.
No, you don't. You don't. You
that's
don't get
the only, that's the trade-off. Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of allocation, like if you're, like you're looking to allocate to tail or chaos or both, what do you think is the position sizing?
Probably something. I would have to model this, but you would model the historical payoff during like crisis events. So during COVID, how much it spiked up, account for the tail risk, and try to size that based on overall portfolio contribution to volatility. I can't eyeball this, but if you ask me to just like pick an allocation, I think like for something like chaos, 10% of your portfolio is good. You think about what Buffett does with 90% in the S&P 500 and 10% in cash. Well, how about 90% in the S&P 500 and 10% chaos? You know, absent crashes, you know, it's just underperformed slightly due to the drag from the fees, but it's more or less been a cash-like allocation. But, you know, in those in however bad of a crash we've had since chaos was launched, it's done pretty well in them, but we haven't really seen a 2008 style event. And that's what I'm interested in seeing what this ETF can do.
Right. Very interesting. I mean, I love the fact that these things are available. You know, when I was an advisor, these things were just simply not, these kinds of strategies were simply not available to me, to my clients. And now I think, you know, advisors have this opportunity to, you know, get into some of these vehicles in order to, you know, make their portfolios more resilient.
You can sell tail risk too. There's a bunch of like, they have barrier income products now where you get paid a fat coupon as long as the reference index doesn't close below, say, a 30% drawdown throughout the year. And that could be benchmarked to Russell 2000. I've seen one benchmark to individual stocks like Tesla where the yield's like 25%. But again, you're just selling tail risk there, right? You have short volatility futures products like S-Vol where they dedicate a sleeve to shorting net front month VIX futures. You benefit from mean reversion and contango. But, you know, during events like 2008, Volmageddon, where the VIX spikes, you could get wiped out, right? These products, these tail risk products, are just the opposite of that. And I think that the one universal thing you should always apply when selecting these is just to keep the fees low, as low as possible. They're not going to come close to an index, but the less you pay, the slower your bleed is, where the better your payoff is. It's just a given of how fund accounting works.
Thanks, Tony. I just want to remind everybody that Tony is a risk management expert. He went to school, he went to Columbia for risk management. So just to give it some context, you know, you're not just talking your book or talking the prospectus. These are actual, you know, products that deserve attention, and you've got the perspective from the mathematical standpoint, the theoretical standpoint to back that up.
People look at risk as volatility, which is completely incorrect. I actually do not like how most fund managers will give you a Likert scale, like 1 to 5 for how historically volatile this fund has been. It's easy for the advisors to explain to their clients, but risk is in investing. Risk is the risk is the prospect for permanent loss of capital. That's it. Right. We're all trying not to lose money here. Over a long enough time horizon, risk is not earning a return high enough to meet your anticipated needs. So there's two. Nowhere in that does volatility come in. Volatility is only a risk when behavior is an issue. And there's a lot of studies out there that show that having a good advisor closes that gap, which is why personally, I don't care about volatility insofar as I am calculating also correlation with my portfolio. Because if you have uncorrelated volatile assets and you rebalance them, you can harvest the premium from there. It's just, you know, the difference between the arithmetic and the geometric mean. You're just reducing that variation in between them. A really good mathematical concept out there called Shannon's Demon, where it shows that basically if you have two non-correlated assets with basically no expected positive return from it, they just go up and down. If you rebalance them, you actually get a positive return out of that. And that is kind of a very simplified explanation behind why it's important to diversify and rebalance. It's really only the only free lunch out there.
Well, I mean, it's especially contextual when you consider that the traditional 60-40 portfolio is currently, the 60-40 portfolio is 90% equity risk, roughly, when you do the x-ray.
Yeah, risk on a risk parity basis, it would be more 20% equity and 80% bonds. That would get you the best risk-adjusted return. But again, the risk there is over 20 years until you retire, you're not going to meet your goals. What people tend to miss is that, you know, war doesn't just push commodities up and down. It makes central bank reactions that much harder to predict. Bonds in this scenario no longer behave as shock absorbers, right? People forget that bonds aren't just something that pays you over and over. It is another way of laying claim to a company's anticipated future cash flows. But what you lack in the upside of equities, you gain in significant exposure to multiple non-market related risk. You have credit risk. You have to worry about the solvency and the creditworthiness of issuer. You need to worry about the rates for comparable bonds issued by other entities, which affects what yours is going to be priced as. It can get significantly complex here. And that's the danger in just saying, oh, I'm just going to throw 40% of my portfolio in aggregate bonds. Like,
well, yeah.
I accept that buying the stock market as weighted by market cap is probably really good because it gives you a natural momentum tilt. It's cheap as dirt. It's low turnover and it's tax efficient. I do not accept that for bonds. And you can look at the SPIVA data where it shows that the underperformance rates for active bond managers are significantly better than equity. There is still an edge in active fixed income management. And you can see that in a lot of providers' lineups today.
Yeah, the bond allocation, you know, like we had 40 years of, you know, or at least the last 30 of the 40 of the last 40 years of, you know, declining interest rates, you know, from what were relatively historically high bond yields, which culminated in, you know, the zero interest era of the last 15 years. And when you look at that and you think, you know, I'm going to continue to do that, It's no surprise that a lot of the traditional bond allocations have gravitated to the shorter end of the yield curve or into private credit or into floating rate instruments or ultra short. It's really not a big surprise. But for those investors who are still thinking, I'm going to get the yield on a 10-year or 30-year duration, that play has come and gone. I mean, that play has been played out. The TLT was down. I mean, it was down roughly 41% over the last, I don't know how many years. And when you look at, you know, what investors are thinking, like some investors are thinking, you know, well, at least you get the yield. Yeah. But if you have any kind of duration, it's going to get eaten up by, you know, volatile yields. Rising.
Get this. You cannot hold your average bond ETF to maturity as a single bond would. These have, you look at TLT's turnover, it is high.
Yeah.
As bonds fell out of the maturity band, they were replaced by new issues. That's why the yield to maturity for this is only a theoretical measure. It's if I just held everything in TLT's portfolio until they all expired, this is the theoretical total return I would get. It does not work out that way. Another misconception here with TLT is lower interest rates will increase its net asset value because of its high duration of 15 years. No. Cuts, like a falling long-term yield, will give TLT tailwinds. A falling short-term policy interest rate, the overnight rate, will not affect that as much as you think. Totally different dynamics there. And, you know, I think...
Well, we saw that last year, Tony, right? I mean, we've seen it several times where you know, the Fed cut rates and at the longer end of the yield curve, at the 10s, 20s, 30s, yields went up.
Yeah.
You know, even during this conflict,
I would never buy a 20-year treasury bond because... Why the heck would I lend the U.S. government money for 20 years? This isn't the Volcker era where it's paying like 12% and non-callable. In that case, yeah, sure, I'll lock that in, but it's going to be callable. Like, they're not going to let you get away with that anymore.
I mean, like, look at what happened even in you know, the beginning of the Iran conflict, right? I mean, you know, instead of having a risk-off event that drove money into the bond market, the assets went elsewhere. They didn't go into the bond market. The bond market, you know, bond yields went up instead of going down. Just most recently, right? I mean, you would think that a risk-off event in the equity market would traditionally have led to yields coming down. That was the ultimate reason for the 60-40 was that when you had risk-off events, equities would sell off and bonds would rally. Like they did it, for example, in 87, yeah. Right? But that's not the world we're in right now.
No, not anymore. Unless I would buy.
Like that's the regime change. The regime change is that we've turned the corner on that, you know, zero and low interest rate environment into a world of persistently higher yields, which is where the higher for longer remark comes from. Which is, yeah, you could get a higher yield in bonds than you have historically at least in the last 10, 15 years, but you better be looking in the right part of the yield curve for that because if you're in any kind of duration, you're taking the risk that you're going to lose on the duration side.
I wouldn't buy bonds at this point. Like if I'm going to have any kind of fixed income exposure, it's going to be high in the capital stack, like higher above the average unsecured bondholders. I'm going to be looking at first lien senior loans. Or interesting option there in Canada, a lot of the banks issue a limited capital recourse notes, which, you know, it's kind of like a hybrid instrument. It helps them meet their capital adequacy ratios over, say, issuing traditional investment grade corporate bonds. And I would say in the risk scale, you have investment grade corporate bonds, then you have LCRNs, and then you have preferred, and then you have common equity. And that's, if you flip that around, that's also the order in priority. If, you know, if the company ever gets liquidated, there's a waterfall. But there's a lot of options out there to tailor your exposure. And this aggregate bonds aren't all they are. If they weren't so damn cheap, nobody would use them. I still think there's a case for the 60-40 in that it is mind-boggling easy to explain, cheap as dirt to assemble, and highly liquid that even a monkey shotgunning a market order in the first 5 minutes of the day could probably get a good fill. That's about all I could say for it.
The other problem, like, okay, now, so let's say, like, I just, you know, so now investors have gravitated to the belly of the curve or lower in the yield curve. The problem with that is that what was once supposed to be a duration play that would benefit from the risk off in equities at those market pressure moments is no longer there. Like, if you're in the short end of the yield curve, you're not going to get anything from a falling equity market vis-a-vis like the duration that you might have, you know, the benefits of duration that you might have gotten in the past. So the problem is that the problem is that while, yeah, you might be getting a decent yield of 5, 6, 7%, depending on where you are in the credit market or in the bond market, that 5 or 6 or 7% is not enough to offset what you might give up in the equity market in those moments. Right? I mean, in terms of that portfolio balance, looking at the market line for your portfolio.
Yeah, it's
not gonna offset it
right now.
Right? It's not gonna provide the hedge. It's just providing the yield.
That's taxable too.
That makes it even worse, right? So yeah. Anyways, I think we've made it abundantly clear that the traditional 40% allocation to the wider bond market is not a good idea. I think most advisors would agree with that. But you know, any investor listening to this might not have gotten there yet. Tony, when conflicts escalate like what we've had this year so far, what we've had for the last, you know, 4 years, who knows what's going to happen in Europe, how things go, if things widen or they narrow. But when a conflict escalates, whether it's today's Middle East or Europe, what do you think are some of the most underappreciated ways that risk actually transmits into a Canadian ETF portfolio beyond the obvious, like defense and energy plays that we've talked about defense, but we haven't really talked about energy today. But what do you think are some of the underappreciated ways? Like, it's so far things are boding well for Canada, right? I think that was the point that I was getting at. Like, what do you think investors might be missing? Like, we've been so U.S. heavy for the last decade, and when the turn came, for example, that now favors Canadian equities, which is, you know, inflation above 3%. Investors are getting into the, you know, have been getting onto the Canadian bandwagon during the last couple of years as it starts to materialize, as it starts to manifest in their portfolios, realizing, hey, my Canadian equities are starting to do better than the US. And they're also looking at the rotation, obviously, into international. There's been quite a divergence between, for example, ACWI, Canada, versus the US. And so what do you think we're in store for in Canada, specifically Canadian investors, that would differ from what, you know, how US investors, I don't think US investors, there's a lot of US investors that are looking at Canada because for obvious reasons, we have the resources, we have the commodities, we've got the oil and gas that are a big part of our index. But what do you think Canadian, like, do we have a blind spot as Canadians in some respects, like because of the recency bias of the US?
Yeah, you do. You're going to have a lot of supply chain repricing.
Yeah.
Margins are going to compress quietly before the next quarterly earnings reflected. And we're going to see these in Canada's narrow but still important industrial sector. I'm not just talking about the two railways. Those are already like in the news because of terrorists. But think about things like Cargojet, TFII, a lot of the distributors too, like Finning, which just, you know, sells Caterpillar stuff here, or John Deere or whatever it was. Like, look, anything in the industrial sector is going to see margins compress, maybe just incrementally. But we know that if they're already trading at lofty valuations, that can really take off a lot of that premium. So I think a lot of people are underestimating that. And it's not because it's not important. It's just the TSX industrial sector is so minor in comparison that you don't really think about it beyond the railways and, say, waste connections. Another one I want to see is that there's probably going to be a currency regime shift. We know that the Canadian dollar is a commodity currency, and Canada, for better or worse, needs to be an energy superpower. Usually in times of stress, the US dollar strength dominates, and that affects your allocation. If you're not hedged against that, that's a tailwind when the US dollar strengthens. But now we're seeing the opposite here. The Canadian dollar has actually held up pretty well. We enjoy a great geopolitical stability premium. Canada is, you know, very steady on exports. We have the rule of law. We have developed natural resource extraction. You know, a lot of room for improvement, but it's there. And people are going to be realizing that. Eric Noodle's been going on and on about how Canadian sand and shale is the option. He's right there, but it's also the Canadian dollar. I remember watching that Civil War movie in the US where they stop at the gas station for sandwiches, and then she offers to buy some gas and sandwiches for like $300, and the guy dismisses it. And then she says it's $300 Canadian, and it changes. Well, I think we could see that here. So I think there's reason to be bullish on the Canadian dollar. Again, I'm not a Forex trader. I don't make calls about the direction of a currency, but it has implications for whether or not you decide to pay the extra drag to hedge your investments against a strengthening Canadian dollar, especially your US ones. And the last one I want to mention is liquidity cascades. ETFs are wrappers. They wrap different underlying assets. If the liquidity dries up in the underlying, you can get really wide spreads or an outright freeze of the creation and redemption mechanism. Some of the things that I would be worried about in a very sharp downturn, such as March 2020, whether it's due to pandemic or war or natural disaster, is likely fixed income. You know, treasuries, not so much, investment grade, not so much. But when you get into the below investment grade, when you get the thinly traded commercial paper, that could be a big issue, as with emerging market equities that are not American depositary receipts and thus trade directly on foreign exchanges. That's something that I would watch out for if your allocation is maybe a bit more exotic than usual.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that the bond market is still an OTC market. It's still an over-the-counter market. And so when you're dealing with AAA, you know, AA, you know, A-rated, even BBB rated paper, you have a much better chance of getting through a liquidity cascade or a squeeze. But when you're dealing with low-grade paper where you were chasing yield and maybe you bought some junk or you bought some poorly rated, you know, below BBB rated credit, the risk that we're talking about goes up dramatically.
Yeah.
It's not just a step change. You know, it's almost like a Geiger counter, like an order of magnitude change in sudden illiquidity.
You can see this on I have a Y chart subscription. I'll pull it up sometime. But you can actually assess the discount to net asset value that a lot of Canadian bond ETFs traded at during COVID. You look at something like XGB, which is broad Canadian federal and provincial government bonds, very minimal. Even at the worst day of the crash, it was maybe like 2% off net asset value. If you go to aggregate bonds, which include some of those mortgage-backed securities and investment-grade corporate bonds, much steeper discount to NAV of up to 4% to 6%. So a corporate bond only ETFs, even deeper at 10. Junk bond ETFs, we don't have a lot in Canada, but they were trading at like double digit discounts in asset value. So imagine, you know, you just watch their bonds fall with stocks during the worst crash. You want to buy the stocks, so you want to do a rebalance there. Great. Now you get to sell your bond ETF at 12% less than what it's actually worth mathematically. Yeah. That's a terrible deal.
It's great if you're Howard Marks. You know, it's great if you're Howard Marks and you're on the Howard Marks end, you know, the buyer of last resort. for someone.
That's
going to be
Morgan. That's Morgan.
That's right.
You know, I worry about a lot of these fixed income ETFs we're seeing with CLOs especially. You know, it's not just AAA tranches anymore. It's BBB. The CLOs themselves have been tested to the 2008 financial crisis. I'm not disputing that here. They're not like CDOs. Yeah. The underlying is corporate paper instead of subprime mortgages. You have over-collateralization tests and stuff. There's a strict waterfall. But yeah, what happens when you put that in an ETF and it trades billions of shares on a daily basis? What happens then? We haven't seen that react yet. Yeah, the April tariff tantrum, they did pretty good. Even the BBBs held up well. But again, like a COVID-style crash, I don't know how. Like, imagine being a bond desk and getting, like, imagine being the bond desk that's responsible for being the authorized participant for maybe three of these CLO ETFs and just getting hit with redemption after redemption during a sell-off, right?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think, you know, look at this, you know, SaaSpocalypse period followed by the Iran conflict. Like, you know, February was really volatile. And then, you know, the Iran conflict just threw another wrench in the works there. But when you look at you know, like, look at what's happening in you know, in the SaaS space with credit, right? I mean, that was part of the problem, is that suddenly Anthropic comes along and you know, the whole sector gets, you know, repriced and the loans come into question made to these SaaS companies, right? I think the you know, the problem that arose there is that suddenly then you have an asset, gold. People, you know, we had this huge run up in the price of gold this past year to new highs, to into the, you know, 5,500 USD for an ounce.
It got pretty high.
What was the highest? Something like $5,500 or $5,600, right? For the high.
It was about 5,000 at one point, US.
But,
for sure.
But because of that liquidity problem that happened in the SaaS space and in SaaS related credit, you know, it wasn't because there was something wrong with gold. Other than that, the fact that it had made a lot of money in the last year, that gold sold off when the war started. Most people expected gold to have the opposite reaction that it did. Right? They expected gold prices to go up when this Middle East crisis opened up. But instead, it went down. It sort of coincided with the credit crunch in SaaS and the lockups at the, you know, in some of those private credit companies, private credit funds, where people sold their gold for liquidity. Right? They go for the low hanging fruit. What's the best thing I can sell right now? And that was gold.
What people tend to find is that risk assets are the ones you can unwind the quickest. It's always been that case. Yeah. Especially after a crowded trade. Now, I have no issues with private credit, private real estate redemption gains. That's the whole point. You commit to locking your money up for the full cycle.
Well, that was just a misunderstanding.
Advertise your product better. Don't sell to advisors or retail who can't understand that, okay, we have a liquidity gate for a very important reason here. Of course, you should never trust the marks that they tell you, because a lot of these are level 3 marks and it's based on their internal models. And also, like half of private assets is just volatility laundering. Yeah, just because you're not marked to market doesn't mean there's low risk. It just means you don't see it or you don't report it.
Yeah.
I digress. That could be a conversation for another day. But
absolutely.
There's a handy chart out there. It looks at the S&P BDC index and it overlays the net asset value, which is very up and down. Mm-hmm. Sorry, which is very smooth. And then the market price, which is very up and down. That's kind of what's going on private credit. When you're in a private credit fund, they report that NAV, that nice smooth line going up every quarter. When you trade these assets publicly and they're marked to market, you get that market price that goes swings up and down, right? Just because you decide not to list and you just report that smooth line doesn't mean that risk there is gone. It's there. You just don't see it. And in many ways, it's the illusion of diversification. It's the illusion of non-correlated returns.
But it's like in this case, like there's private credit. There's nothing fundamentally wrong in the private credit space. What happened was that there was this liquidity mismatch that arose, right? I mean, so you can't, you can't say that you have accounted, like, if the, sure, the credit risk is on side, everything's hunky-dory, everything looks good, it's AAA or it's AA, whatever the credit rating is. you know, whatever assurances you have as an investor, but you can't account for, like what you said, just to bring full circle and close the point, which was that if there's a liquidity cascade, it doesn't matter how good it is, it's going to get knocked down.
Yeah, you're all going to get drowned. You're all going to drown at the same tide.
The same way investors in gold discovered this last month, you know, this last month.
Crowded trades unwind extremely messily. I remember, right? Remember that day that silver fell 30% a day? That was like, what, a six sigma move? Yeah. So at the worst part of that, I took a look at SLV, which is the U.S. iShares Silver ETF. That thing was trading at a 15% discount to NAV. The ETF creation and redemption in-kind mechanism is extraordinarily efficient. Yes, even for physically backed commodities where they got to be moving stuff out of a vault at the end of the day. It could not. SLV, a billion-dollar product that trades hundreds of millions of shares, could not keep up with how much trading there was. So you were being forced to sell it at fire sale prices 15% below what it was worth at the trough of that crash. Like liquidity dries up when you need it the most. And that's, I think a lot of silver, like there's going to be fresh generational bags for a bunch of silver bugs. On that note, that's why I buy the real stuff. Yeah, I need a bit of dealer spread. I got to stick it in my safe. But you know what? There's Mr. Market's not coming out and saying, oh, Tony, you want to sell this? Yeah, here, accept the 15% discount and slap in the face. No, I can wait it out.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about the negatives here, but let me just close off another point that, you know, I asked you at the beginning, which was if somebody told you this was going to be the outcome of the S&P 500 Friday's close at a new high, you know, that's been as big of a surprise. We had a melt up in the equity market when we least expected it.
Yeah, I honestly thought it was going to be worse than this. I mean, I don't time. I didn't hedge. I didn't risk off. I just went to bed and just assumed that, you know, like, okay, well, hopefully my deposit clears so I could buy some more assets. But it's a surprise. Like, you know, don't time the market.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure absolutely like Jim Simmons at Renaissance can, but like, I'm not Jim Simmons. I'm just some random dude in BC.
Hey, so Tony, last question. If you were building a portfolio today for a Canadian investor, and I know you're not an advisor, you're not a portfolio manager, but you are in the space, looking at the market. If you were building a portfolio, you're in the risk management space. You're building a portfolio for Canadian investor, not a trader, but somebody with a 10-year horizon, like a true 10-year horizon, is genuinely designed to be resilient across geopolitical regimes rather than just the past 40 years of relative stability. What does that actually look like? What would that actually look like?
Yeah, I probably start at the core with something like VXC or XAW, which is of iShares and Vanguard All World X Canada. Market cap weight, 22 bips in fees. Every country, developed, emerging US minus Canada. For something like Canada, I probably just grab something like VCN or XIC, and that gives you passive market cap weighted exposure. I have some alts in there though. I wouldn't do any fixed income actually. I would have a sleeve in a market neutral alternative fund. I like the Picton Investments one. Very good Sharpe ratio, even though their fee structure is horrendous. I think it's a 95% base management fee plus 20% of outperformance over a 2% hurdle rate with a perpetual high water mark, which is a fancy way of saying it's basically a hedge fund. But as far as I'm concerned, they've earned it. And instead of fixed income, I probably go to EQ Bank and just make a GIC ladder. They got some good rates right now and not brick and mortar. And that'd be my fixed income. And that would be it. I don't want to trade. I don't want to like express a view with equities. I think market cap weighting is, it's not perfect, but again, you get momentum factor, you get quality because it's biased towards large caps. It's dirt cheap. You're just trying to like make sure you have little sources of drag, self-cleansing. I want to get my alpha in places where there's less space. So I think long short with PFMN would be my tail risk, or it'd be my ballast instead of bonds. And the GIC ladder just... it is more of a psychological thing. I find people are less inclined to panic sell when they bucket a safe allocation elsewhere, and GICs are as simple as it gets. And if you ladder them, it kind of solves the timing of cash flow issue. And, you know, I'm not trying to like promote EQ Bank or anything. I've just had really good experiences with them, like more so than Big Five.
Very interesting. I mean, I think the most important thing here is you know, whatever portfolio you put together, let it be the one you can stick with through thick and thin, because that's probably a much bigger actual risk is your own behavioral risk when it comes to
minimize regret. You know,
like, if you've got a portfolio that you can't cling to when the going gets rough, then it's not really built for you.
It's not. I would have some, like, for a personal spin, I have some other things. Like, I'd have some Bitcoin separate. I wouldn't use an ETF for it. I'd have some gold, again, wouldn't use an ETF. And if I had to own a single stock, I'd probably just grab a few shares of Berkshire whenever it's, 1.5 times book value. They're doing buybacks right now. So unless Abel's lost his mind, I guess he kind of thinks it's, like, fairly valued or close to it. But what do I know?
Quite a bit, Tony. Quite a bit.
I try.
Tony, thank you so much. It's been an incredible hour. We're just on the hour right now. It's been a great conversation. I'm really, it's really great to have you back on the show, and I hope we can do it more often.
Anytime, man. You let me know. I'll find some time in the summer. Well, it's going to be wildfire season here too, so I'm going to be pretty busy. But keep me posted. Happy to chat about anything, and I'm sure something will happen in the world worth talking about.
Absolutely. Never a dull moment with you. What do you think's the biggest surprise in the next 12 months?
Trump's health. Would be surprised. Either both mental health and physical health. I think China, keep an eye on China and the Strait of Taiwan for sure. I think that with the breakdown of U.S. Hard power, there might be a push there, especially as we're coming up on 2030, which is the kind of like, it's kind of like an anniversary date for the Communist Party of China as it pertains to Taiwanese reunification. I would be cautious about Russian and Belarus movement in neighboring countries like Estonia and Finland, who are both rearming right now. As you may know, Canada has a substantial troop contingent in Latvia as part of Operation Reassurance. And I used to think the Balkans was unstable. Now it's really Eastern Europe. Yeah, like geopolitically, those are things on my mind right now. But again, like, I can't really do anything about them. I just think it's worth looking at. If you look at them, they're not really in the news, but just generally, by the time you see it being reported about, it's underway. So, you know, make your own like little dashboard. I have one. I just like to, look at every morning for a sanity check. And it just keeps the urge to tinker and do things in check. You know, stay the course.
Yeah. Tony, awesome. Again, awesome to have you. Excellent conversation.
Well, happy to be on. See you next time.